This episode is brought to you by the Canby Liquor Store. Father's Day is coming, and they really have everything your dad really wants. From hand-selected gifts that you won't find anywhere else, to small-batch bourbons and unique craft beers. Find them in the Fred Meyer Shopping Center.
This episode is also brought to you by Oddmo's Pizza in Canby. Handmade awesome pizza plus craft beer, wine, and cider delivered. Call them today at 503-263-8444.
Welcome to Now Hear This Canby,
your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans, and its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
If it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
Hey friends, and welcome to this episode of Now Hear This Canby. I'm James Walton, your host. Let's read the news. Oregon City Mayor Dan Holliday, who is also a businessman in Canby, has been removed from office decisively, with more than two-thirds of voters affirming his recall in Tuesday's election. Of the 13,586 votes cast, 9,243, that's almost 70%, voted in favor of the recall of Holliday, who was in his second term as mayor. Only 4,300 votes, or 32%, said the mayor should stay in office. Once again, Oregon City residents have shown up in force for ethical and accountable leadership, recall campaign manager Adam Morrill said in a statement Tuesday. Amid the pandemic and wildfire evacuations, our 100% volunteer effort gathered 1,000 more signatures than the amount needed to qualify for the ballot. And tonight, after months of socially distanced hard work, the people of Oregon City have affirmed what we knew all along. Oregon City is better than Dan Holliday. Reached Tuesday, Mayor Holliday declined to comment. This is the first successful mayoral recall effort in the history of Oregon's first city. Commission President Rachel Lyles Smith will serve as the interim meeting chair until a special election is held to seat a new mayor in March, who will serve the remainder of Holliday's term. With the recall officially behind us, it's critical that the citizens remain engaged with local government as we look ahead to electing a mayor who represents our values in the coming months, Morrill said. Until then, I'm hopeful that our community will now be able to heal after the mayor's divisive and destructive tenure. The recall election and the election to replace Holliday will cost the city about $60,000 total. Morrill said the committee to recall Dan Holliday will not make any endorsements for the March 2021 special election to replace the mayor. The recall effort had been driven by a grassroots coalition of dedicated volunteers, angered by comments Holliday had made this year and in the past that were widely viewed as racially insensitive. He had also drawn the ire of his fellow city commissioners and constituents with his loose talk about businesses reopening in April, which drew a sharp rebuke from the state attorney general, and for his behavior at city meetings, as well as alleged acts of corruption, cronyism, and wasteful spending. Recall petitioners held drive-through rallies, set up tables at supportive businesses and farmers markets, and in the final weeks, raised enough funds to send signature sheets to more than 11,000 households. The mayor's recall had been endorsed by all four current city commissioners, as well as three former mayors, five current school board members, former Clackamas County commissioners John Ludlow and Ed Lindquist, and the Oregon City School District superintendent. The Clackamas County Republican Party, however, supported Holliday, saying they found his comments hurt the feelings of certain people, which does not meet the criteria for the recall. The county GOP's action drew a swift rebuke from Morrill, a registered Republican, who said, quote, "This campaign is not about right versus left, it's about right versus wrong." Clackamas County Republicans, along with the Democratic Party of Clackamas County, had also sought to intervene in support of the two Gladstone city councilors facing recall in 2017. Both of them were also removed from office by the voters. While Portland residents took to the streets to cheer, dance, and pop champagne to celebrate Democrat Joe Biden being declared the winner of the presidential election, another group supporting current President Donald Trump gathered at the Oregon State Capitol building in Salem. Among them was Jordan Tibbles, who was recently elected to the Canby City Council, according to unofficial results. "We are not going to let this roll down," Tibbles said, addressing the crowd Saturday in a video recorded by freelance OPB reporter Sergio Olmos.
"So if you are going to be here to fight, we welcome you, we love you, but we are not going to let this roll down. I am not going to look my daughter in the face and say, there was a time where we had free speech, but we rolled over and did nothing when they took it from us. I am not going to do that. I am not going to say there was a time where we had free and fair elections until the media and the establishment deep state decided that they could choose our president for us. No longer are we going to take that. We are going to stand up and fight, and we welcome everyone from every generation who is willing to do that."
He called for Trump supporters to join him in fighting what he characterized as a fraudulent election, the same election in which he is likely to claim victory, albeit in a much smaller race. "Oh, we are fighters," the Marine veteran and first-time city council candidate said of conservatives in Oregon, "and it's gut check time." He told parents in the crowd to ask themselves, "What do I want my children to remember me for?"
"When this crisis happened and they tried to steal an election from us, am I going to look my kids in the eyes and said, darn it, I wish that didn't happen, but what could I do? What could I do? Or am I going to say, we are not going to take it. We are going to fight because we have children who are going to live in this land too, and we need to stand up for them."
The demonstration in Salem included several hundred people, many of whom waved Trump flags and chanted protests of the election results. They echoed claims by many prominent Republicans and the president himself that the election was illegitimate, though they have yet to offer proof of the widespread fraud that would be necessary for Biden to have collected tens of thousands more votes in the multiple battleground states that paved his path to the White House. Some of those in attendance wore jackets identifying themselves as members of the Proud Boys, an organization the Southern Poverty Law Center labels a hate group and links to white supremacy and the alt-right, though the group staunchly denies any racist ideology. Oregon State Police later reported that there have been two demonstrations in the state capitol Saturday, the Stop the Steal rally at the Capitol building, followed by a second one that started at roughly 5 p.m. at Pringle Park and later marched to the Capitol. A Malala man, 29-year-old Nathan Arnett, was one of four arrestees, OSP reported. He faces charges of fourth-degree assault and unlawful use of pepper spray. Clackamas County will be included in a two-week pause that carries further restrictions on long-term care facilities, restaurants, gyms, and other businesses, as well as social gatherings, the governor ordered Monday. Clackamas was among four counties added to the five already on the list, along with Baker, Union, and Washington. Of the counties on Governor Brown's watch list for inclusion in the two-week pause, only Linn County avoided the more draconian measures. The pause measures including halting indoor visits to long-term care facilities, instituting a 50-person maximum capacity in restaurants, including both patrons and staff, and reducing restaurant party sizes to a maximum of six. Outdoor dining and takeout are strongly encouraged. The pause also limits social gatherings to no more than six people if the gathering includes those from outside your household, as well as keeping the same six people in your social gathering circle. There will also be a 50-person capacity for recreational venues like gyms, fitness centers, and museums. However, this does not extend to faith-based gatherings. Jackson, Malheur, Marion, Multnomah, and Umatilla counties were already included in the pause, which Brown first announced last Friday. The pause measures took effect in the five counties on Wednesday, November 11th, and extends through November 25th, the day before Thanksgiving. The two-week pause is being instituted in counties with a case rate above 200 per 100,000 people over a two-week period, or more than 60 cases over a two-week period for counties with less than 30,000 people. The governor said Clackamas and Washington counties are being added to the pause because their case rates are just under the threshold and both counties have experienced significant increases in new cases in recent days. We realize that the news of the two-week pause is something Clackamas County residents did not want to hear, Clackamas County Chair Jim Bernard said in a release Monday. We understand this is disappointing, but it's necessary. In the release, Bernard, along with County Public Health Officer Dr. Sarah Present, urged Clackamas Countyans to do your part and don't wait. We understand people miss seeing their loved ones, and it's more challenging to wear a mask covering and distance when you're with people you trust, Present said. However, we are not going to contact trace or test our way out of this pandemic. The change will come when individual behavior changes collectively. That's in our control. A network of parent groups, including the Clackamas County-based Clack to School, have united to push the state to allow schools to resume in-person learning by January 6, 2021, exactly 300 days since most of Oregon's approximately 600,000 students set foot inside a classroom. The new coalition, ED300, represents the first joint effort by tens of thousands of parents from Portland to Southern and Eastern Oregon, its organizers say. The group Clack to School, which includes some Canby School District parents and students, began organizing in September along with other grassroots organizations to advocate on behalf of students. We witnessed learning losses, technology failures, repercussions of no school-based activities, accessibility issues for students with disabilities, and significant mental and emotional health challenges for too many students, the group said in a press release Monday. Data from numerous states and counties show schools are not significant sources of spread for the novel coronavirus, the group's supporters say. And while the state and county are grappling with an unprecedented surge in new cases over the past 2 weeks, there is no evidence that open schools would worsen these spikes. On the other hand, the group says the mental, social, and educational impacts on children and employment-related difficulties for parents that distancing has brought is now a crisis that must be addressed. The learning losses attributable to remote education are not recoverable for many students with learning challenges, said Jennifer Dale, spokesperson for Clack to School and parent of three school-aged children, including a daughter receiving special education services. The group's renewed efforts come barely a week after the state significantly eased its metrics for resuming in-person learning. Well, that's not enough, says the group. They are calling for the elimination of statewide mandates and county metrics altogether in favor of guidelines that facilitate tailored community-level approaches. We are out of alignment with 42 other states that have guidelines rather than mandates, the group says. Oregon's overly blunt mandates are prolonging closures and harming every age student, from early learners to high school students who need support in their journeys to higher education. The group also calls for greater transparency from school districts about enrollment data, student engagement, grading outcomes, and attendance so parents can make informed decisions about in-person learning and remote options. And for many working parents who are looking warily ahead to December 31st, the likely expiration date of the employer-paid leave provided through the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. Schools will likely reopen in hybrid models, says ED300. Families must understand how state lawmakers will support Oregon's families and parents. In a presidential election in which most professional pollsters and DC politicos were, again, as wrong as sin on Sunday, anxious Americans watching the results trickle might have been better served by simply asking a Canby high schooler. The high school held its school-wide election simulation last week, and students not only accurately predicted the winner, but came within a couple percentage points of his margin of victory. In the exercise, students were asked to cast votes during their second period classes, which were also assigned states and electoral college votes. Of those who voted, 53.1% chose former Vice President Joe Biden, who on Saturday was declared the winner of the real election after building an insurmountable lead in Pennsylvania. While votes are still being tallied, Biden had captured 50.7% of the national popular vote as of Sunday morning. The high school was even more accurate in predicting the Electoral College, the real decider of White House residents, according to the Constitution. Their breakdown gave 51.2% of the available electoral votes to Biden. On the national level, several states have yet to be called, but most media outlets projected the president-elect had won 279 electoral votes. The Associated Press had also called Arizona and its 11 votes for Biden, giving him a total of 290. Taking the percentage of only the states that all major outlets agree Biden has won would give him a 51.8% of the Electoral College, roughly within 0.5% of the result predicted by CHS students. On the other hand, Donald Trump, the incumbent president, did not do as well in the students' polls as he did in the national race. In the high school exercise, President Trump took 43.3% of the popular vote and 48.7% of the electoral votes. Libertarian Joe Jorgensen did well with the high school, collecting 3.4% of the popular vote, nearly three times better than her real performance on Tuesday night. She even received a single electoral vote thanks to the independent thinking voters of Maine's 2nd Congressional District. In an email to high school students and families, Principal Dintz noted that the simulation had also closely mirrored the national election in 2016. So these kids might really be onto something. Canby's legal voters, however, missed on this year's result. Although the early returns showed Biden leading in the three precincts located within the city of Canby, that result had flipped decisively by the final tally, with the president leading his Democratic challenger and apparent president-elect 5,153 votes to 4,557. That's a 51-45% split.
B14 0 68 N 7040.
Hey, Frankie, what are you doing?
Well, I was trying to win this direct link pattern bingo game. That Hallmark gift basket is as good as mine.
Direct link bingo game?
You bet. Our local internet provider is hosting a virtual bingo game to show appreciation for their members. Isn't that cool?
Yeah, super cool. Who does that?
Direct link does. They miss seeing their members during these difficult times and wanted to offer a fun way to stay engaged and win some sweet prizes.
They really do work hard to embody that cooperative spirit, don't they?
Well, October is Cooperative Month, and DirectLink is a cooperative that was started back in 1904 by local farmers, so bingo kind of makes sense. They are one of roughly 260 remaining communications co-ops in the U.S. who provide connections over 40% of the land so that more than 50 million rural Americans have the technology that they need to thrive.
Well, that's pretty unique. So how does bingo work?
DirectLink members were mailed a bingo card at the beginning of September. Simply visit directlink.coop/bingo or DirectLink Facebook page every weekday to get that day's bingo number and cross it off your card. They're playing four different simultaneous games, with the blackout prize being a four-pack of tickets to a 2021 Mariners game.
Okay, wow. Get out of my way. I gotta go get my card right now.
Good luck, you know, on everything except that Hallmark basket, because, like I said, that's mine. All right, joining us on the Canby Conversation again is Jimmy Joyce. He's a high school teacher and the head coach of the Canby Cougar football team. And I feel like in this time, probably just Jimmy, life mentor and support network and life coach to a lot of anxious teenagers. Is that right?
Yes. teachers are teaching and working harder than they've ever worked in their lives, and I honestly think coaches, even though we're not on the field and on a Friday night, you know, against another opponent, we're probably coaching harder than we've ever coached before.
Sure.
Because I mean, the realm of, you know, the role of a coach has now expanded. We've always had those little nuances that, you know, we're kind of mentors, counselors and stuff, but now it's, we're really those parts.
Sure. And I mean, like, high stakes, right? I mean, like, this is, there's some real struggles and some real challenges that kids are facing right now, right? I mean, football is a big deal, but like, this is some life stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, everything that's, I mean, we always say that a football game is kind of like, you know, society on for 48 minutes. You know, there's struggle, there's excitement, there's adversity. Well, now, I mean, there's so much adversity in the world, and, you know, kids are struggling, teachers are struggling, parents are struggling, and, you know, it's how we deal with it right now.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you are, you helped found and are one of the leading forces of this new organization. I feel like there's a few different coalitions that have kind of emerged. We recently reported on Ed 300, which is a coalition of parents groups that are advocating for reopening schools. Your group is the West Coast Coaches Association.
Which, Alliance,
excuse me. Got to get that branding right.
Yeah.
Which is Oregon, Washington, and California coaches. Is that right?
Yes, it is.
Tell us a little bit about what you guys are about.
Well, you know, we are a group of coaches. How this kind of began was, you know, in the former former league, the Three Rivers League, two fellow coaches of my fellow coaches, head coaches, I played with in college. And we decided that we thought we should just meet one Sunday and just talk after the Oregon Athletic Coaches Association kind of sent out an email kind of releasing some data that was quite impactful for coaches, I think, across the West Coast.
Yeah, what was that?
Talking about what's going on around the country, specifically the state of Wisconsin released data on the success rates they've been seeing and what they've been seeing out of high school athletics. For people that don't know, Wisconsin has been one of the most hardest hit states by COVID, but they've been continuing to play high school sports this fall. And the data that they were able to collect was eye-opening, to say the least. And it kind of got us thinking that, you know, we need to be a voice for our student athletes. We need to be the adults in the room and go out there and, you know, be their voice in some way. You know, this summer, which a group that I helped with too, called the Let 'Em Play Movement, was more of an emotional pitch.
Yeah.
And, you know, as many of these organizations are, there's hidden political agendas. We're a group that has zero political agenda. Hmm. We're not out here advocating to open up schools. We're not advocating for anything along those lines. We're out here just to be the voice for our student athletes and to try to get them the same opportunity that millions have received, that have experienced across this country this fall.
Yeah. Yeah. What did that data show from Wisconsin and other states?
Well, so the other states are still coming in we should be getting ready for our second week of the playoffs right now.
Right.
And so other states are still in the midst of the playoffs. So what Wisconsin did is, Wisconsin is one of the largest public university systems in the country, and they kind of just set apart and they showed that the transmission rate among student athletes is so minimal that, in fact, that in some ways athletics was helping prevent the spread than it was actually causing a spread. And they had found that roughly, I don't have the data in front of me right now, but it was...
Come on, you're a football coach. I thought you're just surrounded by stats constantly.
We've been looking at a lot of data from almost every corner of this country.
So all right, fair enough. Anyway.
But the one thing I can tell you is that, I mean, you hear some things out there, there's like... a good example is actually Arizona is a more direct correlation to Oregon, because Arizona has remained largely remote in terms of education, but has continued to play sports.
Okay.
And by allowing student athletes on campus, it has allowed for them to start testing out the protocols necessary to re-enter the classrooms. And the important thing about that was there's roughly been about 97% of games have gone off without any COVID situations. Mm. And of the games that have been called off, it's really affected only 11 schools. And this is not just football. This is volleyball. This is cross country. And in Arizona, also soccer, or girls soccer. Boys soccer is played in the spring. But it's the same thing that's going across the country, even across the border in Idaho.
Yeah. Well, that's really interesting. I think, you know, a lot of people kind of have either seen that or know that a little bit intuitively, especially depending on the sport. But I mean, football is a little bit different. There's obviously some contact, primarily just at the end of the play, right? It's not like, you know, constant contact, but I guess if you're a lineman. But anyway, but a lot of sports, you know, you don't touch at all. Like, and one question I wanted to ask you is, even here in Oregon, when they, you know, different standards have come out, and this has been months ago, but early on, a big question was, you know, they kind of shut down high school sports totally at first, and then slowly started opening them back up, but starting with college sports, and colleges were kind of given a lot more license to do different things. And, you know, the difference there, I felt like, was, well, we're dealing with, you know, adults, people over the age of 18 versus kids, even, you know, college age kids have that right to, you know, understand the risks and make the decision for themselves. Whereas, at least in our legal system, high school kids, you know, maybe don't. How have other states kind of managed those waters? As far as you know, is it more of a parental consent type thing, obviously, or?
Well, obviously, I mean, it's one of the, it is one of, it's a parental consent situation in that it's the same kind of choice about going back into the classroom. We have we have online opportunities and stuff. So there's a choice being made there. What we really want to have is that choice. You know, we just want to have that ability to have the choice going forward. We feel that the protocols that other states have put in place have made this game or made all games very successful. And while there are games that are canceled, that's not because of usually a massive spread. It's usually out of extreme caution more so than anything.
Right, right.
And in fact, the NFL just released a report yesterday that showed they have not found any spread amongst games or practices. It's almost always involving a family or a gathering outside of the team structure.
Yeah, off the
field. In Arizona, they've actually shown that it's less than 1% of students that have contracted COVID, and it's even less among student athletes who are on campus more.
Right.
So it's, you know, there's a lot of things that go into it. I'm not a scientist. I'm just a football coach and a teacher.
Yeah.
But, and we're not, and the biggest thing that I want people to know is we're not advocating for anything to happen right now.
Yeah.
We still have a few months, you know, we still have about a month and a half to go until winter sports are supposed to begin. We want to start that conversation, and we need to make sure that winter sports goes. They're supposed to start December 28th, and we want to make sure that they have the opportunity to go out there and represent their school and their community.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's talk about that, because for folks who don't have a teenage athlete in their house, they may not understand. They you know, I'm sure there are some folks listening, they're just like, it's just not worth the risk. Like, it's just sports, you know. Yeah. I was talking last week, I did an interview with Ashley Martin. Do you know her?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she is the women's wrestling coach for the Canby High School wrestling team. And she's only a couple years removed from high school herself. She graduated in 2018. Yeah. But she was an athlete. She did all the sports. She did wrestling, obviously. She did rugby. She did softball. And she said sports were the reason I went to school. I mean, she was just brutally honest about that. She was like, I went to school because of sports. I probably would not have gone if I wasn't on a sports team. Like, it was everything to her. Those were her words. And she just, she said she can't imagine what the student athletes of today are going through. And I was wondering if you could give us kind of your experience and your take on that as well. Just kind of underline the importance of this.
I think I mean, what Ashley says there is so huge, because that's what you hear so much from student athletes, and also you hear from parents too, that, you know, we've been able to have a lot of access to our student athletes for the last, really since July, but there are some districts out there, that haven't. In fact, the Beamer School District just opened up athletics yesterday.
Oh, wow.
And talking to those coaches and stuff and hearing their stories from their players about, you know, it's tugs your heart, your heart, because for a lot of these kids, it's that, you know, while the term student athlete is very important, that student comes first, a lot of those kids become better students because they're athletes. And when you take that away, it's hard on them. And we were talking to Steve Corey, who's one of the other main figures in our group, the head coach of Lake Oswego. He's one of the most respected men in Oregon high school athletics. Mm-hmm. And he's talking about kids, telling them that, I don't know what to do. I don't want to do it anymore.
Yeah.
And then I'm talking about school, because the thing that made school entertaining and exciting to them is taken away.
Yeah.
And it's hard to tell them to hang in there when they can watch 37 other states playing high school athletics right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, and one of the other members of our group, here's a true 1%. I can't imagine there's too many of these guys around here. The head coach at St. Am Christian down towards Salem is actually a medical doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And talking to him about the social and emotional effect it's having on his student athletes, and he just says, you know, he understands it, and it's traumatic for him. The fact is, the teen suicide rate is climbing too, and that's an alarming thing, and that's something that can't be ignored. I don't think that's the number one statistic you have to lead in with, but that's something we can't ignore right now.
Yeah. Well, and along with that, I mean, it's not just the loss of sports. It's not just the positive thing that sports is in a vacuum. But as you mentioned, when we kind of let off with this interview, there's a lot of crazy stuff going on right now in society, and sports, and just that chance to unwind, to, you know, let out some aggression or just some energy in a healthy way is a huge part of keeping that stability and dealing with stress.
Yeah. Well, and here's the other thing too, that without an outlet, this lockdown has actually shown us a lot of the inequity in athletics, in youth athletics around the country too, because while high school sports has been put on hold, private and club sports hasn't.
Right.
And the fact of the matter is that statistically eliminates a large portion of our population that is already underserved.
Yeah.
Because there are students, athletes that can afford the $4,000 to $5,000 to $6,000 for private training and club sports.
Yeah.
But for a lot of them, high school athletics is the only opportunity they have because of cost.
Yeah.
And by eliminating that, we are really celebrating the haves and the have-nots.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, and people say, like, these kids, if they need that, they can just, you know, they can go to the gym, they can go for a run or whatever. To them, I say, how often do you go to the gym, man? Like, it's not fun to go to the gym. Like, we do it because we have to, because we're getting old and we're trying to stay in shape, but we don't go because we have a blast doing it.
It's the same
for kids. Like, they don't get the same enjoyment just from that exercise.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing about it is, and it's also, you know, you have 4 years in high school.
Yeah.
And it's tough. I mean, it's challenging, and it's not without risk, but it's something that I think it's worth looking at. And obviously, I mean, if someone decides not to take that risk, that is their own prerogative, and I fully respect that too.
Yeah.
And we just want to have the opportunity to have an opportunity.
Yeah.
Because we see what's going on in other states. I can't tell you how hard it is to listen to a kid or a kid ask me, how come I can't be at practice with my buddies? And this is mostly at the start, before we were able to start practice. Why can't we practice, but I can watch an entire stadium full in Utah?
Yeah.
Of high school kids playing football.
Yeah.
And it's hard to say, and you don't really have an answer. You're like, I wish I knew, bud.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Looking forward a little bit, Coach. Next week,
West Coast Coaches Alliance
is going to be doing a virtual press conference. They're going to be kind of sharing. There's hundreds of coaches involved in this, by the way. It's not just a few here and there.
We're pushing 1,000 coaches right now.
Yeah, yeah. Unbelievable.
For something that started a week and a half ago, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah. So next week's a little bit of your coming out party. You're going to be sharing some, as I understand, a little bit more of the specifics of kind of what you're looking for, at least how you're looking to approach this. But again, can you just kind of, you know, I guess assure some people that this is not like, you know, we're doing this no matter what or whatever. Like, this is very science-based, safety-based. This is looking at how other states have done this successfully and doing, you know, finding the best practices for what would work here in Oregon.
Yes. And that's, I mean, you just hit on everything right there. When we sat down and we created this group, our main goals were, we're not a mob. We're not out here trying to demand anything. We are trying to have a seat at the table to start a discussion to get us to where we want to be. We're not political either. We have no political motive in this. You know, we are just coaches advocating for our student athletes. We have zero interest in politics. The other thing that's very important is we are entirely statistically driven and data driven. Nothing that we're presenting is just our own thoughts or beliefs. These are things that have been proven proven with data and collected that can show and hopefully make our point. And it's also important to point out that, you know, we're going to show that there have been mistakes made in other states, and we hope to learn from them and not make those going forward.
Yeah.
And then lastly, the biggest thing too is we are not a movement or a group that's, you know, just trying to pull on someone's heartstrings.
Yeah.
You know, we are trying to bend ourselves in a way that, you know, A, we can be taken seriously, and then two, we can get people's attention and the right people's attention. And that's what next Tuesday is going to bring. We're going to be at the Airport Sheridan. We have a lot of media there. The Oregon Athletic Coaches Association is backing us in this movement, the same as is the California Coaches Association and the Washington Coaches Association. So three very large unions are also supporting us in this cause. And the Oregon Coaches Association will be there too, their leader, and presenting their data that they have access to almost every state in terms of data, and they're going to be presenting their data on why they are supporting our movement.
Cool. And what's the end game here, Jimmy? Are you the WCCA? Are you going to, you know, the members? Are you ultimately going to, I guess, each state's equivalent, but here in Oregon, the OSAA, and kind of, you know, sharing your data with them? Is that where it starts, or is it each member kind of going to each of your school athletic districts and school boards and athletic departments?
Right now we are focused really on, from what we're gathering information, it really rests at the state level with the Oregon Health Association and the governor's office.
Okay.
We feel that the OSA would be ready to act tomorrow. Obviously, we'd have to sit down with them to make sure that they are on board with that. But, and of course, school boards are going to be an issue possibly in some areas. But really for us right now, our goal is December 28th, basketball is supposed to start, wrestling is supposed to start, and we want to make sure that those sports get their chance. And we understand that maybe not all will. But we're going to try. And even though we are largely a football, our group is predominantly football coaches. Right now, we're really mostly focused on basketball and wrestling and the winter sports because, you know, we're coaches. We're not just football coaches. We want to make sure that we're out there and we feel that the most important thing at this moment is that we get a yes and then we can figure out the rest from there.
Yeah, awesome. Well, Coach, I really appreciate you taking time out to tell us about this, and thanks for all your work and advocacy on behalf of our student-athletes. Is there anything else that you'd like to add before you go? Is this thing next week, is it something that the public can watch that we can share links with folks for?
We will have we already have commitments from all the new stations in Portland that will be there.
Okay.
And we will also be sending out Zoom links to watch it virtually. And we're working on a lot of the details.
Awesome.
So I will have more information for you probably later this week.
All right, Coach. Well, hang in there. And again, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you very much.
Joining us now is Donna Ellison of Ellison Team Homes, a firm serving all across the Portland metro area with three realtors based right here in Canby. Donna, can you tell us how Ellison Team Homes started?
I started in real estate. I grew up with my dad. He was a realtor. Mm-hmm. So I'm a second generation broker, and I grew up with him on weekends. And I learned a lot eventually working with him for several years and then going out on my own. Our family moved to Canby a couple of years ago, but we really didn't know how it was going to go. And within the first probably 3 months of being here, we literally fell head over heels in love with this place. We love the community, the spirit here. The first Christmas at Waite Park, I was literally crying because everybody was walking around saying Merry Christmas and people were drinking hot chocolate and we got in a carriage ride with the horse and it was just too much. You just realize it's special here. Real estate's always been my passion. It is my professional love. I enjoy the people, the relationships. So much comes out of kind of the intensity that you spend with people. You're really up in their business for a period of time. And sometimes it's a couple months, sometimes it's a couple years, sometimes it's a lifetime.
Yeah.
I feel very blessed at this point to have people that have been with me for almost my entire career. Mm-hmm. Clients that have bought and sold maybe 2, 3, 4, or 5 homes. I have one client that's bought and sold 8 homes with me.
Yeah.
3 generations. It's a beautiful business. It makes for a very full life.
Mm-hmm. How can people find you?
How can they not, really? we have a website, www.ellisonteamhomes.com.
Well, thank you, Donna.
Thank you for having me.
All right, friends, we're going to wrap this episode up with another rendition of Can Be Then. This time, it's brought to you by Retro Revival. They are not your average antique shop. Open daily, you can find them on the corner of Northwest 3rd and Grant Street in downtown Canby, or connect with them through email at retrorevivaloc@gmail.com. Over the years, the Christmas holiday season has held a special place in the hearts of many a Canby resident. Celebrations of the annual winter holiday date back to Canby's earliest days. In 1873, just 3 years after the town was given the name Canby, the Oregonian recorded a rendition of the Willamette's Ball, an annual soiree that was held here. Many responded to invitations extended, and the comfortable room was, as usual, crowded. The newspaper reported of the event. It is needless to say that affairs were conducted in excellent style, and the music was very fine. All spent a pleasant evening, that may be safely said. Of course, Christmas holds special significance to the Christian faith community, which has long represented a sizable portion of Canby's citizenry. In the early days, many German-speaking Christians called Canby home, and Canby Evangelical Church of North America had many such worshipers. For years, the group met and worshiped in the homes of fellow members, but in 1894, they built their first church, which still stands today at 339 South Township Road. The church was dedicated on Christmas Eve of that year under the direction of its first pastor, Reverend Hermann Schuchnecht. German was the spoken language of the church until 1912. In 1907, tragedy struck a prominent local family during the holiday season as well-known Canby citizen James Fegley went missing under mysterious circumstances. On December 17th, Fegley, an agent of the Russellville Nursery Company, drove from Canby to Butteville, St. Paul, and finally Woodburn on business, staying overnight in Shampooey. The following day, he was expected to return home to Canby, but he did not. In fact, he was never heard from again. His disappearance 10 days ago has aroused much speculation as to his probable fate, the Oregonian reported on December 28, 1907, and it is feared that he has met with foul play. Mr. Fegley drove a black horse with a white stripe on the forehead and had a top buggy, newspapers noted. The only theory that seems plausible is that one, that Mr. Fegley was held up a few miles from Shampooey before it was quite light, murdered, and his body placed in bushes along the road and his conveyance driven away. Fegley's son Grant was a prominent businessman and later a politician in Portland who managed Columbia Woolen Mills. After receiving the distressing news of his father's disappearance on Christmas Day, he spent 3 days scouring the boggy underbrush on both sides of the 12-mile road between Canby and Shampooey, to no avail. Mr. Fegley was 62 years of age and resided with his daughter, Mrs. John Reidman, at Canby, the Oregonian said. He was in usual cheerful spirits, and the idea that he is a suicide is not entertained by his family. The authorities throughout the valley have been requested to look out for the supposed murderers with the stolen horse and buggy. Throughout the 20th century, the Christmas tree industry began to take root in Oregon, and Canby farms were part of the early boom. In 1918, the city's farms harvested an estimated 40,000 firs and distributed them all around the world. In 1924, a snowstorm dumped several inches of white powder on Canby just in time for Christmas, and though the youngsters enjoyed the chance to build snowmen and indulge in other frivolities, the storm caused the city no small amount of trouble. With 3 or 4 inches of snow and slush covering the ground here and no lights or water, Canby was in a plight as a result of the storm, which started at 7:30 this morning, the Oregonian said. Snow fell most of the day. Electric lights and telephone wires were damaged. The water supply ran out early tonight. Several accidents were reported on the highway during the day. 3 years later, an airmail plane piloted by N.B. Evans was wrecked near the Clackamas County Fairgrounds in Canby shortly before Christmas. Don't worry, there's no evidence to suggest the plane struck an airborne sleigh pulled by 8 tiny reindeer. Instead, the pilot reported that his engine had gone dead as soon as he passed over Canby at an altitude of about 1,200 feet. Evans initially attempted to land on the fairgrounds' fine racetrack, but he couldn't make an approach due to the electrical wires. After landing in a nearby field, the pilot, who was uninjured, began promptly disassembling the aircraft so it could be transported back to Portland for service. Only the landing gear and the left wing were damaged in the unplanned landing. Scandal rattled through Canby in 1929 as a series of disgraceful episodes were reported on the city's streets on December 25th. It is alleged that one young man of Canby was found in a drunken sleep early Christmas morning and was taken home by a friend in a car. Canby Herald reported the following day. Other young men, or boys, are said to have been drunk on the street Tuesday evening, but no arrests were made. Gambling was also allegedly witnessed on the Christian holiday, a vice that had been the scourge of many upstanding citizens that winter, according to the Herald. Much indignation has been aroused as a result of the alleged outrages uncovered Christmas Eve, the newspaper reported. And Knight Officer Bowsbly, who is looked to for the preservation of peace and dignity, was the subject of more or less censure. According to the paper, several prominent citizens had gathered at the post office on the day after Christmas to demand something to be done. Unless adequate means of protection against such infringement upon the peace and dignity of the community is given, it was pointed out, there will be justification in enlisting the aid of the state authorities to clean up the town, the Herald said. From what can be learned by current reports, there seems to be no doubt that some of these requests are justified. The week of Christmas in 1988, 6 migrant families from Mexico facing eviction from a Canby church found themselves in new warm surroundings and on the receiving end of food, toys, and clothing donated by community residents. The families, consisting of 43 people, had moved into the Iglesia del Dios Vivo on Juniper Street earlier that month after their work teams had completed and they had nowhere else to go. But the presence of that many people in the aging building represented a safety concern, and the city had informed them they would have to find new lodgings. Enter the Canby Grove Christian Conference Center, which put up all 43 souls in comfortable cabins on their property. Other generous Cambyites flooded the center with donations after hearing about the migrants' plight. When the bus showed up to transport the workers and their meager belongings to their new temporary living quarters, the families began singing religious songs, the Oregonian reported. Many parents held hands with their sleepy children and carried babies in their arms. Finally, one last tale from Canby's Christmas history. In 2001, library patron Felicia Sheeran checked out a video that contained an animated version of the poem "'Twas the Night Before Christmas," along with several other holiday cartoons from the 1950s. She also checked out a book containing the same classic Yuletide poem. Both media contained depictions of Santa smoking a pipe and drinking a cup of holiday cheer. Sheeran returned the book and movie with notes saying the materials were inappropriate for her 6-year-old daughter and 3-year-old son, and demanding that they be removed from the library. So, on December 17th, just in time for Christmas, the library board issued its ruling. The materials would not be removed from the children's section. Policy held that censorship is a purely individual matter and that the library does not act in the place of parents with regards to materials that children select. Library Director Beth Saul sent a letter to Sheeran notifying her of the board's decision and thanking her for her interest and involvement. And that, friends, will do it for this episode of Now Hear This, Canby. I'm James Walton. As always, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day.
Hey, Frankie, you okay? You seem kind of down.
Yeah, just bummed. Miss going to the Wild Hair. I know you can still get takeout and all, but it's just not the same.
You know they're open again, right?
What?
Yeah, they've been open for a while now. Don't you cover, like, the news?
Hey, I'm only human, okay?
Okay. Well, I can tell you that the Wild Hare and their amazing staff are thrilled to be open again for delicious meals and fun times. They are strictly following all the recommended safety guidelines, and they have the only covered outdoor patio in Canby, with lots of tables spaced 6 feet apart and umbrellas also spaced 6 feet apart, and fantastic ambiance. And hey, if you're still more comfortable with carryout, they can hook you up there too. Find their menu and other information online at thewildhairsaloon.net or check them out in Canby and Oregon City. Anything to add, Frankie? Frankie? Oh, I guess he left. God, he must have been really hungry. Now Hear This, Canby is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. And of course, our show is edited by Cameron Clausen. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden. So a round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Canby by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. To find more work from her, you can visit her website, olivia13.com.
Now Hear This, Canby is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The production of Now Hear This Studios, Canby's locally owned, full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe, and we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.